Succession number 28897, Reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with George Oliver in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 3rd of 3rd, 2006, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. George, I wanted to talk to you about the lead-up to D-Day, and you were mentioning to me off-air the experiences that you had with training for the day, particularly with mass groups of planes in the airfields.
Yes, well, we practiced what we called mass takeoffs, towing gliders. And the way we did this was that we went to our Stirlings and we ran them up in the usual manner and got them ready to become airborne. And then we taxied them out onto what we called the perimeter track. That was a perimeter track right around the aerodrome. And we all waited lined up there, some on one side of the runway and some on the other side of the runway. And beside the runway, there were all these gliders, a line of gliders, and they were facing not quite at right angles to the runway, but they were pointing a little bit in the direction that we were to, they were to move off. And then we would get a green light when it was our turn, and we would taxi forward and swing onto the runway and taxi down until we got a red light. And when we got the red light, we stopped. And I used to put my aircraft, put full brake on then, and then a lot of ground crew would get hold of a hawser glider and push it out onto the runway behind the aircraft and connect it to the tow rope, to connect the tow rope to our aircraft. And then we would get an amber light, if I remember rightly, and at that stage I would open up my engines to full throttle, full power. And then when we got the green light, we would go forward towing the glider. Now the glider always got airborne before we did, so it was imperative that he maintained the exact station to prevent us from having our tail pulled too high or too low, so that we could get a good takeoff. But of course, we'd been practicing this individually for a couple of months now, so we were all pretty proficient at it. And as each aircraft went off, then the next one would run onto the runway, turn onto the runway, have a glider fixed, and off we would go. Off he would go too. Now, we practiced these mass takeoffs quite a few times in the months prior to D-Day, and we were getting them off at about 45-second intervals, and with practice we got it down to about 35 or 36-second intervals, which meant that we could get the whole of the squadron airborne in half an hour from when the first aircraft got off, or less than half an hour probably. And we were learning this with the prospect in view that we might have to follow the army around and move around helping the army in the battlefield. Well, this didn't really happen excepting on D-Day and Arnhem and the Rhine crossing.
It sounds as though it was a highly orchestrated affair.
Yes, it was. It was very well organised. And it was quite enjoyable to do too. Really, we used to enjoy that.
I might have been hairy though when the gliders are taking off. Your tail's going up when you should be going down, or something.
Yes. Well, there was always that little bit of a hazard, but the main hazard with those mass takeoffs was that you couldn't get too close to the slipstream of the aircraft in front, because he left like the wake behind a boat. Well, it was the same in the air. You had this slipstream coming back at you, and if you got into his slipstreams, it could rock your aircraft, and perhaps the glider would probably snap its tow rope or something like that. So that was really the governing factor, was how soon we could take off. We had to let them get down a certain way before they gave us the green light.
You mentioned earlier how you sort of manipulated the throttle with one hand to keep the engine's level.
Mm.
To what degree were you having to operate the stick in the situation with gliders sort of being wayward behind you?
Well, one thing the glider did, which was to our benefit, and that was that the Stirling couldn't swing to the right like it loved to do, because the weight of the glider on the back kept it straight, you see. So really, it was more rudder than anything, just steering down the runway. And, of course, once we got flying speed, the rudder controls were quite good. At first, you had to do it with your brakes. Your rudder pedals were connected to the braking system, so you could use them as little brakes, you know, air brakes they were in the Stirling. And I didn't really have to open the throttles quite so much, but as I said, I was on full throttle when I got the green light. When I got the green light, I was on full throttle. And I don't know what the other pilots did, but that's what I did anyhow. And so the throttles were already open, and we just screamed down the runway with this glider on the back. So, and we took off, and if he maintained the high position, we always, in my experience, used the high position, high toe position. And he had to keep out of our slipstream. That was his main worry.
So he had to keep above or below you?
Yes, well, taking off, he had to keep above. He couldn't keep below us, but he had to get above the slipstream. And otherwise, he'd be buffeted around too, you see. So, and they were very good at this, those glider pilots. I've mentioned before that they did an elementary flying course on powered aircraft, Tiger Moths, the same as we did. And they were a great bunch of blokes too. And so we did these mass exercises. And as I've mentioned before, we did night exercises, towing gliders and paratroopers out into Salisbury Plains. And
once the Stirling had a glider behind it, you were in flight. Did it perform differently?
There was the weight there, but no, not a great deal differently. Of course, you couldn't. Your airspeed would be reduced a bit, but I don't recall that it gave us any real problem. We got that used to it that we didn't really notice anything. But at first, we may have done. I can't remember too much about the details at first. But at any rate, we'd been doing these smallish sort of exercises over Salisbury Plains. And did I mention the time that my glider broke loose? I think I might have done. Did I? I did. Okay. Well, I won't go over that again. But at any rate,
they had to spend a night out in chilly air.
That's right, yes. Well, I won't go into that again. But
presumably a Stirling pulling a glider was going slower and would be an easier target.
Oh yes, we were sitting ducks all right. There's no doubt about that, yes.
I understand that the guns that you had on board had been whittled down to virtually nothing.
Yes, we just had the four guns in the rear turret. We didn't have any other. The only thing, the pilot had the luxury of a steel plate behind him. he was the only one that had any protection.
Presumably the tail gunner would stay in his tail gun.
Oh, yes.
You mentioned one chap that had
Yes, we had one scarper. But at any rate, in April, there was an enormous rehearsal of D-Day, and we didn't really know exactly that it was that. But 38 Group and 46 Group, Royal Air Force, in conjunction with some help from the United States Troop Carrying Command, we lifted the whole of the 6th Airborne Division into the air in England, and at night, gliders, paratroops, the lot. And I've read since in the history of the Airborne Divisions that, although, as he said, we didn't know it at the time, it was a dress rehearsal for D-Day.
Well, let's talk about what that was like to be involved with.
Well, no, it was quite awe-inspiring in some ways, because I'm not sure whether we carried paratroops or gliders that night, but at any rate, one thing I do remember was that we were flying along in a stream, and we must have been in the middle of the stream. There were quite a few aircraft ahead of us. I should mention on these exercises that we always had to navigate to a rendezvous point so that the other squadrons could all get together. But that was just a navigational thing. And then we flew along in a stream. It wasn't formation. You didn't go. You didn't. The formation was too dangerous. Sometimes, if you tried to fly formation, one shell could knock out three aircraft or something like that. So we flew in, I suppose you'd call it a loose gaggle in a way. And the aircraft in front of us on that particular night were releasing gliders. Quite a few. There was several hundred aircraft involved. They were releasing these gliders. And the gliders, when you released them, they always went up a bit. And I'm not sure the exact reason, because they weren't going any faster, but it must have been because in the tow position they were kept in position, and they had a tendency all the time to lift. And they went up, and then we found these gliders coming down across our path, you see, like this. So there were all these sorts of things that did make it a bit hairy. And as I said before, and I'll reiterate that when we get onto the actual D-Day crossing, you had to try and maintain your exact height as best you could. Otherwise, you could get people from above coming down, and people and your stuff dropping onto them and everything. So I think that's probably sufficient about what we trained to do so far as the airborne versus.
Presumably, you don't know exactly what the future holds, but you're talking amongst yourselves and having conversations about what all this might mean.
Mm. Well, we knew it was D-Day. There was no doubt in our mind about that, but we didn't know that this particular night was so big, and that it was an actual dress rehearsal. Because you really only see what's within eye distance, you know. And we could see dozens and dozens of other aircraft and gliders. And
it must have been a pretty awe-inspiring
sight. It was. Well, I always used to say, you know, we've got one of the most interesting jobs in the Royal Air Force. And it was much more interesting than some of the other jobs, I suppose. A lot of people had very interesting jobs too, but anyway, that was my opinion at the time. And
so you're realising that D-Day, the day, is going to happen.
Yes.
Let's talk then about as the fifth came about, the day that you would literally prepare for the sixth.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what was involved. You wake up in the morning. What happens?
Yes. Well, we'd been confined to camp for a couple of weeks, there'd been a couple of cancellations because of the weather and so forth. But on the On the 5th, we woke up and after breakfast we went down and had a look at battle orders, and we found that we had to go to a briefing for the night. And so we went to the briefing, and we were told that we were going to have to transport airborne troops over the Normandy, and we were given a talk by all the people that usually gave you a talk, the CO. He told us that we were well trained and that he was sure of the success of the event, and gave us his best wishes. The meteorological man came along and told us what the weather would be like. It was going to be wet, windy, very gusty, and quite a bit of cloud about, so it wasn't going to be a picnic. And then the intelligence officers and the gunnery officers and navigation officers came along, and we were given the position of the drop on the map, and then we had to make out our flight plan in the normal way to get there. The navigator and the bomb aimer and the pilot usually involved themselves in that. And so that was that. And then we had to go out and start up our aircraft. And when we walked up to our old Stirling, there it was with all these three white strips, about a foot wide, painted on each wing and on the fuselage. And the logistics of that really made an impression on me, because we didn't know anything about it. And there were a lot of aircraft that were done. Every aircraft that was going to take an actual part in the D-Day landings was painted like this. And it, of course, it was for our own protection, because if any aircraft that didn't have these white stripes on it would be subject to attack by the enemy. And also for the warships too. One of the golden rules we were always told, and was never fly over a warship. Whatever you did, don't ever fly over a warship.
Presumably those stripes were...
But we had to that night.
All right, well, we'll talk about that. But you mentioned these white stripes. They were to show your own plane that you were okay.
That's right, our own plane and the ships below too, yes.
So we're talking about these white stripes, and it's going to save you from being shot at and all that stuff.
Yes, that's right. And because there were a lot of umbrellas of fighter planes and that over us, flying around to protect us, and they were above us and below us. We didn't see them, of course, and I don't know whether there were too many there that night or not, but in the daylight raids, they certainly, you could see them around, you see. But so we went out and we saw these stripes, and then we checked our aircraft over. I ran the engines up, made sure they were okay, and the bomb base had been loaded with the supplies we were going to take, and we checked the aircraft over, and so there was nothing to do then. So we just had to wait until we got the order to come down and pick up our gear and be taken out in the evening. And so I had a few butterflies in my tummy at the time, and got a bit, I think it was a feeling of a mixture of apprehension and excitement in a way, when I look back on it. But at any rate, whatever it was, there was no way that I could just sit still and mooch around or anything. So because I felt like this, I walked back to my hut, which was quite a long walk, and they had a PA system right through, so wherever you were, you could be called in easy enough. And so and I had a shower, how to shave, polish my shoes, and all for just something to do, really. And because the weather predictions, it wasn't going to be cold. We were going to drop these airborne boys from 800 feet, and so we weren't going to run into cold weather. It was windy and wet, very windy and wet, but it wasn't cold, so I thought, oh, I'm not going to wear any flying gear tonight. You've got to wear your helmet because it's got the earphones in it. And in any case, it's good protection in a fire. I always wore gloves and goggles. Well, I mightn't have had the goggles on, but they were hanging around my neck. And that was the same thought, protection from fire. But I didn't wear any gear apart from that. So I just went out to the... Oh, later on in the day, of course, or in the evening, rather, we got the call to go and pick up our parachutes and our gear and get out to the aircraft. And then we were out there probably an hour before takeoff, and we had to go check our aircraft and run our engines up again and make sure everything was right. And
what was that feeling like? That okay, now it's on. We've got to pick up our parachutes?
Yes. Well, as I say, I had... Oh, well, I do remember... thinking, you know, on those special duties things, I suppose we were going into the unknown then, on those to some extent. But when we knew it was D-Day, and it was so important, if it failed, we knew that either the war would be greatly prolonged, or that we mightn't even win it. That's the way it looked at that to us hands-on pilots, or to me anyhow. And I really felt that we were going into the unknown, and I can remember thinking to myself, I wonder what it's going to be like, you know, I wonder what it's going to be like, and I wonder if we'll come back from it. But at any rate, that's how I felt before I got on the aircraft. But once I got in and started the engines, I didn't think any more about those sort of things.
Well, people talk of having something to do and you suddenly, you know, you forget about everything else.
Yes, that's right.
But people also talk of having pilots having superstitions and you know, I would take your rabbit's foot and all that sort of thing on a flight. Was that something that you ever experienced from...
No, I never ever took a mascot at all. I don't know why, but I didn't. I'd just like to... talk about something that happened on the way out to the aircraft. When we eventually picked up our parachutes and went out to the aircraft, there were all these airborne soldiers standing there just by our aircraft, and they all had black on their faces and leaves in their helmets, and they had grenades hanging on them and machine guns. They were strapped on their shoulders and, you know, all that sort of thing, you see. And they really did look fierce. I remember thinking, I'm glad they're on our side, these blokes. And at any rate, the officer came over to me, the officer in charge came over to me, because I was 22 years old and looked pretty young for that even, I think. And he said, are you the pilot of this aircraft? And I said, yes, sir, I'm the pilot of the aircraft. He said, have you been over before? And I said, yes, I've been over a few times before. And he said, oh, that's good, that's good. And then he looked me up and down, and he said, good God, man, you look as though you're going to a bloody dance. So that started off the sort of rapport that we had with the other troops. They were all strangers, but we had this sort of instant rapport that we were in it together. And and then he gave me a little 5-franc note. That's it there.
Well, tell us about that. It's in your book, and we should make mention of the book. They Didn't Just Drop from a Cloud, by George Oliver.
Yes, well, I wrote that because I hadn't seen the story told about 38 Group and what we did. and I wanted to leave a record for my family. It started off as a story and ended up as a book. But that's the way things happen, isn't it? Yes, that 5-franc notice, when, after he told me I looked as though I was going to a dance, he pulled out this 5-franc note, which all the 17 lads, number 9 stick they were, from the 5th Parachute Brigade, I think it was, of the 6th Airborne Division. And they'd signed all this, and he gave it to me as a little gift. And I've treasured that all my life. I don't know what happened to the lads, I've never found out. But at any rate, so we got in the aircraft then, and as I say, my butterflies disappeared once I started the engines up. I was so absorbed with what I had to do that I felt okay. And it was the same old procedure. We went out, we didn't have to take a glider that night, so we lined up on the perimeter tracks with our troops, and we were given an amber light probably, and then you go around onto the runway and get a green light, and away you'd go. And so we took off with our troops all on board, 17 of them there were, with all their equipment, and our bomb bays were full of equipment for them as well. So we were going to drop them by parachute as well at the same time. And so we headed off towards Normandy. And it was, as I said before, it was very windy and gusty, so it, we were able to do a reasonable airspeed across the channel. And as we crossed the channel, we could see searchlights and flak and stuff coming up there. And various lights flashing. I don't know what was going on really, but at any rate. Oh, one thing I should have mentioned too is that we had to drop on lights. Now these lights were put there not by the pathfinders of the Royal Air Force in Bomber Command. They were put there by the Independent Parachute Company. They must have been a special company, and they were taken over in aircraft from Harwell. Harwell was the main 38 group station. I think that's where the headquarters were. But at any rate, they were taken over from there, and they were parachuted into they were obviously parachuted in. And there were also gliders went over as well and prepared these lights. They were, as I understand it, they were on pipes that stuck up, you know, on the top there. And we had to drop on these, you see. We had to navigate to them, and then that was the actual spot where you had to drop. And so, yes, and then as we got closer in, of course, there were hundreds of aircraft around, and there were slipstreams. You couldn't sort of always miss them, and that, and the aircraft was heavy because it had all these soldiers in it, and we had to fly at a definite height, because if you flew any old height, the people above would be dropping their parachutists on top of you, and if you were too high, you'd the same thing, you drop yours in amongst the aircraft below. So we all tried to keep the same height, but of course it's not that easy. It wasn't that easy in those days because our barometric pressure altimeters weren't a precision instrument like they've got today. But at any rate, we did our best to do that. But despite this, I know of one occasion at least where a poor old paratrooper did run into one of our aircraft. And also, with the load on and flying at this slow speed, I'm not sure of the speed now either, but the airspeed was something a bit above stalling speed, but not a great deal. So the aircraft, they felt sort of wallowy, you know, like a boat sort of does a bit. in waves, and so it was quite a tricky business, really. And at any rate,